and civil rights. As I was saying, that the laws that were denying the black people equal access to the bus, the movie theater, the restaurant, the bar room, the hotel, all these laws, state laws and local ordinances, became increasingly illogical, unfair, and outrageous. There was a feeling throughout the country that the time had come to do away with these laws. And of course, the Supreme Court had moved in 1954 in the famous decision known as the Brown case that segregated, that separate but equal schools did not provide equal opportunity in education, and that these separate but equal segregated schools were unconstitutional. And the court insisted that a process of desegregation be undertaken, and that school integration be the pattern of public education. From this decision, powerful forces were generated to do away with every vestige of segregation, and to the everlasting credit of the young people of America, they took up this cause and threw themselves into it with great dedication and commitment. Young men and women from all over America poured into the Southland, into the southern states, determined to help the black people of that area break down the walls of segregation. And then there were great leaders that were rising amongst the black people themselves. The traditional leaders were fortified and strengthened by new voices. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, under the direction of one of the most remarkable men of our century, Roy Wilkins, was leading the fight in the courts, in state and federal courts, to tear down these walls of segregation and to open up the society. And then there were others like Whitney Young of the Urban League, who had gained respect, who had gained the respect and confidence of the white, of leaders in the white community all across the nation. And the voice of Whitney Young was a powerful voice for equal opportunity. And there was Bayard Rustin, B-A-Y-A-R-D-I-N, Rustin, R-U-S-T-I-N, closely associated with the American Federation of Labor and CIO, who was bringing the message, who was bringing to the attention of the working, of the union people of the nation, the evils of segregation. There was that courageous, beloved and dedicated man of organized labor, Philip Randolph of the Sleeping Car Porters, who from the days of Franklin Roosevelt to the time of John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson was the voice of conscience and decency for black people. I know him. Philip Randolph will be remembered as a giant in this struggle. He did not always capture the headlines, but he was in every battle, consistent, constant, persevering, and mobilizing the power of the American labor movement in behalf of civil rights. And make no mistake about it, the success of the civil rights movement depended in a large measure upon the active support financially, morally, and politically of organized labor. And Philip Randolph helped bring that about. He and Bayard Rustin and Roy Wilkins, a powerful trio. And then there was the Civil Rights Leadership Conference, headed by Clarence Mitchell of Baltimore. That leadership conference represented organized labor, the churches, the civil rights organizations, in a well-organized, unified structure. It was able to reach out to all of the states and localities and bring to bear upon the Congress the influence and the requests and demands of people from many walks of life in every state in the Union. It was possibly one of the most effective lobbying organizations for a good cause that has ever been witnessed in Washington. And Clarence Mitchell, the executive director, is entitled to a great deal of the credit. His contacts with people in the Congress were always were very effective. He enjoyed the respect and the attention of members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, Republican and Democrat alike. He was able to talk to conservatives as well as liberals, and he knew where the sensitive, and he knew where the power areas were. In other words, he knew that legislation had to clear the judiciary committees of the House and the Senate, and oftentimes the committees on commerce, as well as labor and education. It was in these committees where Clarence Mitchell and the Civil Rights Leadership Conference bear their influence and power. And make no mistake about it, they had both. There were new voices on the civil rights horizon as well, and powerful new voices. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., a young Baptist minister from Atlanta, the head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, soon became the true voice of the civil rights activists. Dr. King was a powerful orator, a man of tremendous vitality, and able to move an audience and to arouse great popular emotion. He worked very closely with his people. He talked to them, he walked with them, he prayed with them, and he exhorted them on to great sacrifices and courageous challenge. He was without a doubt the most impressive personality in the civil rights movement and one of the more impressive personalities of the 1960s. Like John Kennedy in the White House as our president, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., out on the roads and the highways and the streets of the cities of America, of the rural areas and cities of America, was the vibrant, active spirit of a new American conscience. There was an awakening in the nation, and indeed there was a rumbling that there was a movement that could not be stopped, despite the unbelievable brutal efforts of local police authorities and the more clever and subtle efforts of politicians who were still
living in the
politicians and elected political leaders who continued to appeal to states' rights and the southern traditions as they sought to hold back the tide, the inevitable tide of social change and progress. There was the Southern Manifesto of the governors and political leaders of the South, both at the state and congressional level, who sought to stem the tide of judicial decisions and legislative action, as well as citizen action, to break down the barriers of segregation and discrimination. These were dramatic and turbulent times, and new voices were being heard, some of them very radical and militant, some of them conservative but truly dedicated, but most of them appealing to what was best in America,
the American,
our belief in equality, our belief in fair play, and above all, our sense of idealism about human dignity. The labor movement, the churches, and civic leaders, North and South, black and white, were united in a massive effort to turn away from the ugly days of segregation and discrimination into a brighter day of human rights. It was very much as I had said in Philadelphia in 1948, when I called upon the Democratic Party to walk out of the shadows of states' rights and into the bright sunshine of human rights. The amazing development of the 1960s was not so much the riots, the social disorder, and the militancy which was so much evident. But the fact that our political system was able to survive, that our social and economic order continued to develop despite all the strains that were put upon us. It often reminded me of the airplane flights that I've taken. You will leave an airport and it seems quiet and calm, and you board the plane, and you're well on your way, and everything seems all right. Then all at once, the captain announces that we're going to enter into an area of bad weather, and that we will be faced with some very serious turbulence. He asks us to fasten our seatbelt, and at this time, a number of thoughts run through one's mind. You can't help but ask yourself, is the captain and the co-captain competent, experienced, mature? Do they really know what they're doing? And you hope and pray that they do. You then ask yourself, I wonder if this airplane is strong enough to endure the unbelievable stresses and strains that will be put upon it by the thunderstorms, the wind, the rain, and all that you will encounter in this bad weather system. And then you also ask yourself, I wonder how all the passengers will react if it gets really bad, and when it appears that we may very well not even make it. All these human emotions spring forth as one goes through a period of bad weather in a flight, let us say, from Minneapolis to Washington. You ask yourself a host of questions, and really it is a test of one's faith in the pilots, faith in the plane itself, and faith in yourself. This was very much the way it was in the 1960s. We went through an unbelievably bad period of social disorder, violent social political thunderstorms, filled with passion, emotion, uncertainty, giving off fear, and doubt, and suspicion, and even panic. And you couldn't help but ask time after time, I wonder if the president and the vice president, the members of Congress, governors, and all really know what we're going through. I wonder if they're capable of handling the situation. And then there were those, and I'm sure there were many, who asked time after time, is this political system of ours the right one? Can it take the test and the strain? Can it take the tension and the strain that's being imposed upon it by all of these incredible developments in the cities and on the streets and highways of America? You just hope and pray that after the storm, you just hope and pray that the ship of state will carry one through the storm. And you watch and wait for the blue sky and the sun to be visible once again. And of course, that's exactly what America is doing. It has come out of much of the turbulence and the violent storm of social change. And we as citizens are looking out our respective windows of our ship of state, wondering when we will see the blue sky of tranquility, of harmony, and of peace, and the sun that assures us of a happy life. That is yet, developments yet to come. But I think it is fair to say that much of the storm has been endured, that the changes have been made, that our ship of state, its political and economic structure, has been sorely tested. Some places it has been found wanting, but that it did not crash, that it held together, and that it brought us to at least a safe port. We have not completed our journey. We will yet have to take off again and proceed towards our ultimate destination of a society in which there is no discrimination, in which there is equal protection of the laws, in which there is justice and fair play for all. And all of this within the framework of representative government and the protection of human rights and the safeguarding of and all of this in the framework of representative government dedicated to safeguarding liberty and human rights. Yes, our journey is a long one, and our destination may sound like utopia, but the fact is that humankind must reach out for things yet to be done and accomplishments yet to be achieved. It is this driving force of hope for a better day, this belief that our forefathers had that we must strive to make a more perfect union and establish justice and assure domestic tranquility that keeps us on the move, striving, struggling, and from time to time holding on for dear life, even retreating, but then to move once again to a new and higher ground. This is what we mean by reform. Reform is change, and change for what we believe is the better. It is not perfection, but it is progress. And as de Tocqueville so well put it, that reform only serves to reveal more clearly what still remains oppressive and now all the more unbearable. The suffering, as he put it, has been reduced, but one's sensitivity has become more acute. What happened was, what happened in the 1960s was simply this. People found that they could change the political and social order by popular participation and by determined political action. There were reforms that were enacted at the national and state and local level. Segregation laws were struck down as being unconstitutional. Discrimination on the basis of race, creed, or sex was declared unconstitutional. New job opportunities were opening up for the minorities, black, brown, the women, and there were all kinds of laws being passed to assure all American citizens their civil liberties and their civil rights. Yes, laws were being changed. The political structure was being reformed. But it is one thing to change a law and to revise and remodel a political structure. It is yet another thing to change the habits of people. But the purpose of law is to make sure that people's habits and practices, which may be unlawful, are controlled and regulated. In other words, laws set standards for human conduct. And these standards in themselves help to change the habits and practices of people. So the struggle of the 1960s was twofold: to change the laws, to bring them in line, to bring them into conformity with the Constitution and its commitment to equal protection of the laws. And at the same time, to change the attitude of people so that racism, which has plagued the American society since the beginning of slavery, could slowly be eradicated, not only from the legal structure of the nation, but from the social and but also from the social and political habits of our people. It's a long struggle, and as yet we have not seen that day of the sunshine of human rights. But we've gone through a testing period, and we have learned a great deal. And we have proven to ourselves that our political system can change, and that it can do so without being torn apart and cast aside. We have demonstrated that the American people are willing to make change if they're but given a determined and committed leadership. In other words, the structure of our ship of state has endured the test. In the 1960s, the captain and the co-pilots on the flights, two presidents, President Kennedy and President Johnson, and their vice presidents, were able to guide our ship of state through these perilous and dangerous storm clouds of social change, and bring us safely on the journey. To be sure, we were shaken up. There were injuries. There were people who wanted to get off and stop the flight. There were even those who tried to take over who tried to take over, who tried to panic the passengers, and would have liked to have taken over from the pilot and the co-pilot. But the fact is that our ship of state did not crash. We did not cancel the flight. We did not turn back. We did not crack up. We continued. And possibly the words that best express the determination of the 1960s in a host of social concerns were these words: "Let us continue." Those were the words that Lyndon Johnson spoke after the death of John Kennedy. He asked the nation to continue on its journey of progress and change. He asked us to continue to make the reforms that were so necessary if each American was to be brought into the mainstream of American life. I've often thought of those words of a great English philosopher of the mid-19th century, John Stuart Mill. It was he who said, "Let a man have nothing to do for his country, and he shall have no love for it." It's my belief that what we were seeking to do in the 1960s was to permit people to have something to do for their country, asking them to join in the building of the nation. And in this way, we would create the true patriotism, a love of country, not the patriotism of parades and speeches and trumpets and guns, but the patriotism of heart and spirit, the patriotism of participation in the building of the nation. A strong country and a great society are not the work of magic or instant creation. They require the efforts of generations, and above all, they are forged out of tremendous sacrifice, suffering, pain, and agony. It's only through these experiences that people come to understand and appreciate what freedom means. 1960s was characterized by rage and passion, by emotion and truculence, by bitterness and hatred, but above all, by an unceasing demand for a new social order. And what was that social order to be? One of broader participation by the American people in the decisions of their society, in the decisions that affected their lives. It was to be a social order in which people were to count, in which individual rights were to be protected and guaranteed. It was to be a social order in which the gates of opportunity were to be opened wide, and where government and other institutions would help those go through those gates, those who had been so long denied even the opportunity to knock at the gate. It was a new social order in which the young people were to be heard, and where the voices of the young people were to be heard, and where their concerns were to be given serious consideration and action. The 1960s were not years of defeat, but rather years of revelation and rebirth. But any objective observer will have to admit that out of those years came a better America, better in the sense that it provided opportunity for more Americans than ever before, better in the sense that our young people were getting a better education than ever before, better in the sense that the courts of our land were more considerate of individual rights than ever before, and better in the sense that we said more people shared in the fruits of their labors, yes, of our gross national product, than ever before. In the 1960s, we had the courage to wage war on poverty, and indeed to recognize that America, with all of its affluence and power and greatness, was still afflicted by abject poverty for a host of its citizens. Over one-fifth of our people lived in the misery and degradation of poverty and hopelessness. And yet we had the audacity, yes, the courage in those days to declare war on this enemy of ours called poverty. And we began to mobilize our resources for the long struggle that we knew it would be. To be sure, like many wars, we were not well prepared for it. We were not well prepared for it. First of all, we did not truly understand our enemy, and particularly those who were in command were unable to understand the enemy because so many of our commanders had never visited the areas of poverty, nor were they acquainted with the cruel injustices that inflicted so many of the victims of poverty. Nevertheless, we mounted a massive effort, and its whole purpose was to provide maximum opportunity for the poor themselves to have something to say about their lives. It was not just a war to provide more income for the poor. While that is important, it was really, in a sense, secondary to what the ultimate purpose and objective was. What we sought to do in the war on poverty was to give people a chance to share in power, to give them an opportunity to make some of their own decisions, to develop their own organizations, to participate in what became known as community action. Oh yes, this was a messy business, and many of those who were brought into positions of responsibility and leadership failed in their trust. Many of them didn't really know what to do, even when given the chance. And why? Because they've had no experience. The poor were always poor. The poor were not only poor in purse, but they were poor in education, in experience, in understanding. They had never had responsibility, so when it was given to them, they didn't quite know what to do with it. But like a child, they had to learn. And like children, they make serious mistakes. They make mistakes which are costly and sometimes sad and painful. Nevertheless, children grow up, and most of them become responsible adults. And it was my belief that the poor, the poverty-stricken, those who had been denied so long because of race, creed, color, or economic status, if but given a chance, and if we would stay with them, have the patience that was needed, and give them the time that was required, that out of their own midst would rise the leadership that would guide them to a new standard of life, a new sense of fulfillment and happiness. What went wrong with the war on poverty? From my point of view, two things. First, it was never given the ammunition that it needed. In other words, the money, the appropriations, the facilities that are required to wage a massive war against such a subtle, devious, tenacious, and brutal enemy. Secondly, the command was changed just in the beginning of the war. President Johnson started that war on poverty, and we were beginning to make progress. The gap between the rich and the poor was narrowing. The number of people in poverty was diminishing. The statistics speak for themselves. And then a new administration came into power, an administration that did not believe in that war, an administration that saw fit to cut off the supply, the resources that were necessary to even wage the war, and the commander-in-chief and his lieutenants wanted to abandon the fight and to give up the struggle. In fact, as far as the commander-in-chief and those and his lieutenants were concerned, they were unacquainted with the enemy. In fact, I doubt that they ever even saw him. So why fight? Why continue the struggle? And slowly but surely, the war on poverty turned into a retreat rather than an offense, rather than an offensive. And the victims of poverty and the ranks of the people in poverty began to grow. The battle was being lost. But the war has not been lost, because there were those who for the first time in their lives saw that things could be different. And they will not give up the struggle. They may be temporarily driven back into the hills or forced to hide out into the caves into the ghettos and the caves of injustice and oppression. But they will come out fighting again once there is a new call to arms from a commander and from a society that cares. That time will come. And the experience that was gained in the 1960s will stand us well in the struggles that will come in the late 70s and 80s. The American people will never be content with anything less than a victory. We are a people determined to build a better society, a more perfect union. What is needed is a clear call to arms, a declaration of war that touches the hearts and the minds of our people and appeals to their sense of decency and fair play. With that kind of a call, and with leadership that is determined to wage the struggle, that understands the enemy, and has an appreciation of our massive resources and strength, the victory can be won. So the 1960s was but the preface to a long chapter, was but the first chapter in a long book of social development. I join with the great English historian Arnold Toynbee in his belief, quote, in his belief that, quote, our age will be remembered not for its horrifying crimes nor its astonishing inventions, but because it is the first generation since the dawn of history to which mankind dared to believe it practical to make the benefits of civilization available to the whole human race. End of quote. Toynbee's vision is of the world. And indeed, In the period of the 1950s and 60s, America truly believed that it could help make the world a better place for all mankind. But our government also believed that we could make America a better place, and that we could make the benefits of civilization available to every American. That's what the civil rights struggle was all about. That's what the war on poverty was about. That's what we meant by the Great Society and the New Frontier. That's what words like the New Deal, Fair Deal, New Frontier, and Great Society are all about. These phrases that described the philosophy and the thrust of administrations were but capsule statements of commitment, of dreams, of hopes, and of challenges. And if America ever gets to the point where it has no hopes and no challenges, then America is dead. I happen to believe that the spirit that has moved this nation in the past and must do it in the future is one where, while we recognize having problems and difficulties, that we're able to take those problems and make them into challenges and difficulties and transform them into opportunities. That's the difference between defeat and success, the difference between giving up and going forward. Paragraph. There were some things that happened in this period of the 60s that I want to recall. I remember so vividly the uprising in Watts, in Watts, California, that suburb of Los Angeles. When you went there to look at it, as I did immediately after the burning of Watts and the riots and the violence in that area, you were bound to ask the question, why would people engage in a riot in this area? After all, the homes look very good. They look very much like middle-income homes. There were wide streets. There were nice lawns. There were some parks. Why was it then that people in Watts, the black, get into violence and disorder? And period. The answer is not easy to find, but there were reasons. Watts was like an area separated from the main body of the metropolitan area of Los Angeles. Watts was without a hospital. It was without doctors. It had no industry. If people wanted a job, they had to leave Watts and travel miles to find work. The school system in Watts was surely nothing like it was surely nothing like it should have been. In other words, Watts was a segregated community, cut off from the mainstream of the life of the great metropolitan area. And the income of the people in Watts was low. The social services were few. The governmental offices that people in Watts needed to visit were way downtown in Los Angeles, miles away from where they lived. And then, too, the people who lived in Watts were not ignorant and illiterate. They were, in a sense, quite fairly well educated. And that made them all the more sensitive to their plight and to the fact of discrimination which so characterized their existence. Ignorant people, illiterate people, are easily subdued. more easily controlled and subdued. It was the black person and the black family in Watts that could see how other people were living so close by, that had some education, that had their television and their radio so they could sense and see and hear what was going on in other parts of America. It was these people who became totally exasperated and disgusted with their lot and said that things had to change. And raging anger and fury consumed them. This was what started the riot. And this is what shocked America. Watts told us that segregation and discrimination were not just Southern, that these the message of Watts was that segregation and discrimination were not just to be found in the South. But indeed, all of America was infected by this social virus, East, West, North, and South. Segregation and discrimination were practices deeply ingrained into the social fabric. And Watts was the alarm that told the nation that trouble was on the way, that red-hot fury was sweeping the black community, and that no longer was the black man to sit silently and stand apathetically while his rights were being denied and opportunities, while his rights were being abused and his opportunities being denied. America was shocked by Watts, and public officials from Washington to California huddled together asking themselves, what went wrong? What shall we do? How can we prevent another Watts? Fortunately, there were leaders in the black community, religious leaders and other religious leaders, leaders in the labor movement, and in the business and professional and educational community that joined with their government to try to find ways and means of relieving of righting the wrongs, of relieving the suffering, and setting America on a new course. Watts was like a slap in the face at the American, at America. It awakened us from our indifference, and it shocked us into a realization that something was wrong and something had to be done about it. This was no riot on the streets of, this was no confrontation on the streets of Birmingham, Alabama, or Bogalusa, Louisiana. This was California. This was Los Angeles. This was the new America of the West. And here was Watts, a community that looked, that surely was not a ghetto, and that had none of the scars of filth and poverty that characterized so many of our poorer sections in the urban areas. No, here was Watts that looked so typically American. Lawns, houses, trees, and shrubbery. And yet here was pent-up fury on the part of black people who knew that they were being denied, who knew that things were wrong and that they would never be better until they took a stand. So Watts was in a sense the Paul Revere of the 1960s. Watts did not say the British are coming. What it said was that change is coming. And it asked America to wake up before it was too late, to try to deal with the social, with the long and persistent social malady of discrimination and bigotry and prejudice that was so much a part of this nation's life before it was too late. I went to Los Angeles shortly after the riots, and I sat down and visited with the business leaders in the Los Angeles metropolitan area. I did this in my capacity as the chairman of the President's Youth Opportunity Council and as a personal representative of President Johnson. I called in all the defense contractors in the area and asked them what they were doing to open up jobs to the black people. And what I learned was almost unbelievable and incredible. Here were prominent business executives who I'm sure did not feel that they were in any way bigoted or guilty of a prejudice. And yet it never seemed to dawn on them that a determined effort had to be made to open up their employment, to open up employment and job opportunities to the black people that had gathered by the thousands in the metropolitan area of Los Angeles. And then too, our government had so many regulations that in a very real sense would have compelled the employers to deny jobs even if they wanted to make them available. For example, every defense industry at that time was operating under a regulation which required that no one be employed who had any police record. Well, it just so happens that in the black community, thousands and thousands of young people in particular have at some time or another been apprehended for some minor crime or misdemeanor. They've either been booked in a police station, or they've been brought to trial, or they've been listed in the records of a juvenile court. And when a black person would apply for a job, he would have to fill out a questionnaire or answer questions about his background. If that person did not tell the truth, he automatically was ruled out as a possible job recruit. If he did tell the truth, and the truth included the fact that he or she had some police record, minor though it might be, then too, the job was denied. I was amazed to find how inflexible this rule was, because sometimes the so-called crime was nothing more or less than a youngster who had been caught taking off a hubcap and was listed in juvenile court for this misdemeanor. Nevertheless, that particular misdemeanor followed that young man's record right up to the time that he wanted to apply for a job. I brought this information back to the attention of the President and the Secretary of Defense. And I'm happy to say that promptly those regulations were changed, and minor offenses no longer stood in the way of a person getting a job. And even some offenses that were not minor were overlooked, particularly if the job was not in a highly sensitive area. The Defense Department is always super sensitive about things, about security matters. And when I looked over some of these jobs and job descriptions, I could not for the life of me see why anyone who had had a minor police, who had had a police record of very minor consequence, should be denied work. After all, there were no real secrets that were going to be divulged. It was just that the Defense Department had an overdose of security neurosis and projected that feeling right out to the personnel officers. But the situation did require that the rules and regulations be changed. And it also required that the manager of a plant instruct his personnel officer that the rules had been changed. Because we soon found out that it wasn't enough merely to have the so-called big men of the, it was not enough to have the corporation president or the manager of a plant to know that the rules had been changed. The personnel officer had to be so informed, and not only informed but instructed. Otherwise, the message never got down to where the hiring was done. Then too, the labor movement moved into action in the Watts area. I remember the magnificent work of the United Automobile Workers, and particularly the work of Walter Reuther, in helping to bring new industry into Watts itself, so that job opportunities could be provided there in the neighborhood for the people that lived there. There were many efforts made. Some of them failed and some of them succeeded. The important thing was that people were trying, that people were learning, they were doing something. They were not giving up. A new hospital was constructed. Businesses were opened. Government services were brought into the area. So the tragedy of Watts turned into a new day for that area and for the people that lived there. Out of the pain and the suffering came something that was better. I suppose it's quite true that Americans only learn the hard way. Or maybe I should expand that. People only learn the hard way. Nothing comes easily, and surely nothing comes without a struggle. We entered into fine program, we initiated a fine program for the youth in the Watts area. We were able to take over a National Guard camp and to recruit young people for summer camp, to give them recreation opportunities. And here again, it required decision. I can recall the concern that so many people had, that if we brought these young people together into a military installation that would be made available by the Department of Defense, that we might again have trouble, that there might be riots. It was my responsibility as chairman of the President's Youth Opportunity Council to make the decision as to whether we would proceed. I insisted that we proceed, that the facility, that the military facility be made available, and that supplies be brought in. Those supplies, by the way, were the product of cooperation between government and the voluntary agencies. And we had as our counselors and guards at the camp people who were deputized from the U.S. Marshal's Office and other law enforcement officials who were willing to volunteer. plus leaders in the community. Several thousand young people were brought together during the summer. During that summer, and no disturbance, no turmoil, no trouble, but thousands of young people had, for the first time in their life, an opportunity to engage in wholesome recreation under proper professional supervision. These camps were opened in many parts of America. We began to use abandoned military camps for youth opportunity and youth recreation. We launched a massive program of finding jobs for our young people. And in the year 1967, in the years 1966, 67, and 68, we had as a goal not less than 1 million young people between the ages of 16 and 20 who were unemployed that were to be given work opportunities during the summer months. And we fulfilled our goal in each year, bringing together government at federal, state, and local level with private and voluntary organizations. Hundreds of thousands of young people were brought into industry, into shops and factories, into government offices, and civic organizations, being given jobs and having the opportunity to gain some experience and to develop some work habits. This is what we meant by youth opportunity. We meant it and we practiced it. Alongside of all of the work programs were, of course, the Neighborhood Youth Corps, sponsored by the federal government, the Job Corps camps, and the civilian and the Conservation Corps. All of these added together in those dramatic years of the 60s gave millions of young people the first opportunity they'd ever had to earn some money and to have it come to them legitimately as a result of their own effort, and at the same time to make a contribution to their society and their community. It wasn't a program that commanded national fame or attention. It made no headlines, but I think it made a difference in the lives of millions of young men and women, or of thousands of young men and women. And it's always been my feeling that if you have a choice between making a headline and making a difference, that it's more important to make the difference. And that's what we did. I also recall my first visit to the area, to the Lawndale area of Chicago, in South Chicago. I had worked in the field of workers' education and adult education. I thought I was rather well acquainted with America, having been in all of the states, visiting rural and urban areas, and being privileged to associate with the wealthy as well as the poor, as well as the middle income and the poor. In other words, a man that has been in the national political scene, a candidate for president and vice president, surely has seen a great deal of this country. But I must confess that what I saw in South Chicago, at Lawndale, was something I had never witnessed before, and I venture to say that most Americans have never seen. And regrettably, most public officials have not seen it. I say this because, to me, the only way that we are going to, because to me, as I see it, the only way that people in public life are going to be able to be a real help to the downtrodden, the poor, the illiterate, the unfortunate, is to know them, or at least to know the circumstances in which they live and survive, to sense, to feel what these unfortunate people go through. And you can't do that by just reading about it or having someone tell you about it. To understand poverty, you have to smell it, taste it, to be associated with it, or at least to have it touch you, if only for an afternoon or a day or a week. I've often felt that it was more impressive to me to walk through the ghettos of New York and Cleveland, of Chicago and Detroit, than it was to have read 100 volumes of the most scholarly dissertation on poverty, its causes, its effects, and its meaning. Well, I went to Lawndale to see how the programs were working that the federal and state government had launched in our effort to wage war on poverty. And at Lawndale, I saw a remarkable development on the part of the governmental system. And when I say government, I speak of all levels of government. We must not continuously differentiate between federal, state, and local. The people think of government just as government. They don't think of it in terms of Washington or the state capitol or city hall. To them, politicians are politicians, no matter what job they hold or where they live. To the average citizen, government is just government. It's public officials, bureaucracy, agencies, departments, and the average citizen, and particularly the poor, do not differentiate between City Hall and Capitol Hill, between the State House and the White House. To them, it's just the government. It collects the taxes. It has the police. It makes the rules and the regulations. And those people, and most people, are not students of the governmental structure. Well, at Lawndale, fortunately, I saw where government was working together. There were what we call employment opportunity centers. In one major structure, yes, one big building, all of the social services of the city, of the state, and the federal government were brought together so that those permitted the individual that might need some help or was being recruited for some assistance to be able to have brought to bear whatever services and facilities were needed in his or her case. But what was most amazing to me was how were the difficulties that well-intentioned people and highly organized agencies were running into. For example, in an effort to employ those who were unemployed and had been traditionally unemployed, new problems were encountered that in no way relate to the average unemployed person, to the ordinary, to the average person who has just lost his job and is waiting for a new one. In the war on poverty, we were seeking to find work opportunities for people who possibly had never had a job, who had always been on welfare, or at best were underemployed and traditionally without work, without meaningful work. These people had no, these people were not in any way prepared to hold a job or to fulfill the requirements of a job, even if one was available. So imagine, if you will, a most generous and compassionate employer that was prepared to offer, let us say, 500 jobs to people who were the hardcore unemployed. If those 500 people were to turn up for work, most of them would have left their job after the first week. Not because the pay wasn't good, not because the working conditions were unsatisfactory, but simply because the hardcore unemployed had no experience on any job. It was a frightening experience to them. They didn't know what to do with themselves or with their work, and they just ran away from it. So here you see a situation which generally doesn't find much notice in the average college textbook or the daily newspaper. In Lawndale, young men and women were being recruited from gangs. And how were they recruited? By people who were called finders. These were people who somehow had been brought into the program and had some confidence in what was being tried and were willing to go on out into their neighborhoods and to find the young, and to find particularly the young people who seemed to just disappear into the ghetto. These were not the kind of unemployed that registered at the employment office. These were the invisible unemployed. These were the lost souls, so to speak. These were people who needed work, who ought to work, who were physically capable of work, but who had never worked, who had become outcasts, so to speak, or at least would fade away into the alleys and the streets and the halls and the bars of the ghetto. And for those few that were willing to come by their own free will, without the encouragement of anyone else, oftentimes this group likewise would be so untrained, so ill-prepared for work, that even if a job at high pay were offered, that the individual simply couldn't handle it. So at Lawndale, in the center that had been established, there was first the process of finding the people that needed to be trained and brought into a work experience. And what kind of training did they need once that they were available? They needed the training of how do you get on a bus and get to your point of training. And after you've got your training, to get to your place of work. He has to train people how to meet a bus schedule. Not just to get on a bus, but to be at a bus on time. After all, many of these people had never had to be on time for anything. Time was meaningless to them. And then, simple things like personal hygiene. How to take care of themselves. How to clean themselves. Men, how to shave, how to comb the hair, how to wash their hands and face, how to prepare themselves for a job, and the same thing, of course, for women. When you speak of this, it seems almost impossible that anyone could know so little or be so ill-prepared. But mind you, there are thousands, yes, hundreds of thousands of our fellow citizens that are in exactly these circumstances. And the war on poverty, as it was called, found this to be the case. In other words, we began to discover the face of poverty itself. Not the image of poverty, but the true face, the true body of poverty, with all of its degradation, humiliation, filth, ignorance, and illiteracy. And then these same people, after being recruited, would have to be trained. And there was a constant problem of getting them to come back for their training. After all, they had lived lives of disorganized lives. Their lives were essentially one of survival, not of purpose or organization. And to train the whole life and to redesign the whole lifestyle of a person is no small task. Even to train the person, such a person, how to punch a time clock required patience and perseverance. And then once that the individuals were trained, the people were trained, it was then the matter of taking them to their job. It was found that when you brought these people to the job, that after the first week, over 50% of them would have disappeared. It was too much for them. When the first coffee break came, some of them would leave. And by the end of the week, the employer would find that about 50% or more of all those that had been recruited and employed simply didn't turn up for work. This within itself must have been very discouraging for all the people involved in the training, the recruitment, and the employment services. But one has to keep in mind that we were dealing the people who you were dealing with or who you were working with. These were people who had never had responsibility, who had no work experience. They didn't know what it meant to be on time, on a job, at a specific assignment, to take orders, to follow rules and regulations. This was foreign to their very existence. So it was found that it was necessary not only to bring people to the job, but to bring counselors, yes, aides, associates right along with them. In other words, to sort of shepherd them to the work and on the job. Now you can say, well, was it all worth it? Indeed it was. Because many of these people became good workers. They provided for themselves, they earned their own living, and they started to make a new life for themselves. You generally hear of the mistakes and the failures, because that makes the news. But there were literally thousands of cases where lives were literally saved, or where people began to truly live rather than just survive, where they learned to do a job and did it well, and with that came a sense of pride and fulfillment. Oh, the human interest stories of training in these, in that period, of job training in that period, are amazing. I recall one story of a young woman in New Orleans who had received training at Loyola University on one of the job training programs. When she received her first check, she was ecstatic. It was the first time that she'd ever received a check that was not a welfare check in all of her life. She was a woman of approximately 30 years of age, and she had 4 children and no husband. She had been on welfare all of her life and her family before her. And under the job training program, this woman had received her first income as the result of her own work, her own accomplishment. The story is that she came back to her teacher in the night school classes of job training in Loyola and excitedly and with great emotion showed her teacher and the and her some of her former classmates her check and said this was the great happiest day of her life, that at long last she was free because it was her money, that she had earned it, that it didn't come from the welfare office, but it came from her company. And she spoke of it as her company with a great sense of attachment and pride. Those are some of the stories of the war on poverty which need to be told. Or I'm sure that there are many stories that would offset this, because there were failures. Or should I say, there were times that we didn't succeed. But the success stories are contagious, and each story of success brought new gains for many more people. I also recall the time that Mrs. Humphrey and I went to Cleveland following the dreadful riots in what is known as the Hough area, H-O-U-G-H. The mayor of the city was Ralph Locher, L-O-C-H-E-R. We had come out there on a weekend to attend a meeting at Cleveland and to visit in the Hough area. I shall never forget talking to the city officials about that area. When we were prepared to go into the area on Sunday, we were informed that we could not go in without a number of police surrounding us and indeed preceding us. In fact, as I recall, the mayor wanted a mounted patrol, officers mounted on horses, to go alongside of us. He said that people just didn't go into that area without that kind of protection. I told the mayor and the other authorities that this I would not permit, that we did have Secret Service plainclothesmen, but not many of them, and they would go with us, but that I was not going to go in there as surrounded by the police, as if I was an unwanted guest, an unwanted visitor, a foreigner, and a threat to the mayor that I was the vice president not only for, I told the mayor that I was their vice president, that I was unafraid, that I wanted to go in and see the people there and to let them know that somebody cared about what was happening. The city officials at least urged that I not take Mrs. Humphrey with me. They thought it would be too dangerous, but she insisted on going, and I insisted that she go with me. So the two of us went into what is known as the Huff area of Cleveland, the ghetto, torn by dissension and bitterness, violence and riots. We came on in with no uniform police, with a very small Secret Service protective force, because we didn't have many Secret Service. And I met there with some of the people who were trying to put things back together in that torn and destroyed area. I recall that there were some church groups at work, and they had purchased or received two buildings that they were going to make over into apartments. And on that Sunday day, with hundreds of people gathered around us, I dedicated those two buildings as a new community self-help housing project. I walked amongst the people. In fact, my wife and I went from house to house, shaking hands with the people, visiting with the people, talking with people as they were sitting on their porches, visiting with them on the streets. And never was there a word of hostility. Always a look of amazement, of disbelief, of wonderment. Really, was this the Vice President of the United States? You could read it all over their faces. And when I would tell them, yes, that I was their Vice President, they were so amazed and so pleased. I don't recall ever being afraid at that time, nor do I recall any reason for us to be concerned. We were there as their public officials, as Vice President of the United States and their Vice President. I tried to convey to all of those people that their government cared about them and was concerned over what was happening. And I believe that my presence on that Sunday afternoon in the Huff area of Cleveland did a great deal to restore confidence on the part of the people in their government and to reduce the tensions that everyone knew were so evident. But I still recall the cleavage between the establishment in Cleveland and the Huff area. I shall never forget being told by the city officials that you must not go into that area without a heavy police guard, and that above all that we should have a mounted patrol. And I'm proud and happy to this very day that we said that we rejected that advice, because the people of Huff, like the people of Watts and the people of Lawndale and Harlem and the ghettos of Detroit, need to know that their government officials trust them and need to know that their government cares about them. To be sure, there are risks, but the greater risk is to ignore what is happening, and above all, to separate yourself from the people. One of the real dangers of high public life is that your circle of acquaintanceship becomes so limited. that you're always listening to what other people tell you about other people, rather than getting out to see what the other people are really doing, what they are, who they are, how they live, and where they live. Risky, yes. Dangerous, possibly. But I think the question needs to be asked, is it more dangerous and a greater risk to remain aloof and at arm's length and to ignore or avoid those that are there and what's happening to them? I think the greater risk is just that. Norman, on the Martin Luther King matter, I want us to get a copy of that speech that I delivered the next day after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. It was up in New York, as I recall, or up in that area. It was before a small business association. Marshall will have it. I believe that speech says more than almost anything I can put down here on tape. But I'm going to put down just a little extra, but it ought to fit into this particular area of the, or this particular part of the book. It was April the 2nd, 1968. And Muriel and I were on our way. Muriel and I were attending the annual Democratic Congressional dinner at the Washington Hilton Hotel. The place was packed. Over 2,000 guests had gathered together for an evening of fun and politics. The mood was festive, and Democrats were enjoying themselves to the utmost. The House and Senate Democratic campaign committees were putting on a